you for being on the show with us.
No worries. Yeah. This is a nice Saturday afternoon here.
It's Friday, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, my world.
You're good.
Rhyme or free, it doesn't matter to me. It's my bad poetry. Good day, and welcome to My Bad Poetry, a podcast where we take a deep dive into our poems from youth, yesteryear, or even yesterday, always asking the question, why in the world did I write this? I'm Aaron.
And I'm Dave.
And today we have with us an engineer, a professor, a public speaker, a poet, with a new collection as of last year called Homeland of My Body. Oh, and did I mention just the fifth of six total inaugural poets in the United States, as well as one of 12 recipients of the National Humanities Medal for 2021? Meaning, if you had asked Dave or I even a couple months ago, I think it'd be safe to say we could have never imagined we'd have the honor to say one day, one today of all days. Richard Blanco, welcome to My Bad Poetry.
It's great to be here. Great fun today, I think.
Yeah. Pretty fun, but Aaron's intros are always terrible. He he really slathers on the saccharine sweet whatever.
I kind of name drop something there. Yeah. So should we get that conversation out of the way? What's it like to meet two living presidents? I mean, or more. I don't know how many you've met. But
it's been an amazing experience. It's kind of terrifying in a different way because, I mean, I'm not an Obamaphile, but I'm obviously a fan of Obama for, like many of us, for many reasons. But sure. It's that whole don't meet your heroes kind of thing. So yeah. I really didn't meet him at the inauguration because that's just crazy. You know, that's just like, you know, a whole crazy schedule. But right. I did get asked to visit him in the Oval Office, and I was like, what if he's a complete jerk? You know, and I'm happy to report he wasn't. It was like the president next door. You forget he's the president. Like, wow. So yeah, I said a few things that I was like, like, this is this is so disarming that you feel like you're just talking to your neighbor, you know, like, so. So that's fun. And then of course meeting Biden. Well, Biden was vice president during the 2013 inauguration. So he was like, nice to see you again, Richard. And I'm like, hey, Joe. He's also a very kind man. So yeah, it's been a wonderful. I mean, I still pinch myself, you know, a little working class immigrant gay kid from a suburb in Miami in the Oval Office, you know.
That's so cool. Now, I did see of the other 12 from 2021, Elton John was one of them. Am I correct? Yeah, did Elton you get John. To meet any of the other 12 or are yeah. they handed out throughout the year?
We have a big pre-award dinner the night before, and then we're kind of like sequestered in the White House like the whole day without any alcohol. And we're all nervous. Like, mm-hmm. It's really funny. I mean, not nervous, but like, yeah. You know, it's a big deal, right? So yeah. they didn't let us have any cocktails till after the ceremony, probably for a good reason.
Probably, but, right.
Oh, yeah. I met Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Bruce Springsteen, Gladys Knight, Amy Tan, Colson Whitehead, who are some of the Vera Wang. And it was really nice because everybody is not, you know, they're not, I mean, I was fangirling, but, you know, they're all in a very comfortable space and very open to conversation. So it was like so much fun. And Julia Louis-Dreyfus was one of the first persons I met, and she's like, "Oh, Richard, we're so happy to see your name on the list. We've been reading your poetry for years." I'm like,
"That's gotta feel amazing."
Thank God I wore my Depends because, like, I was like done. But you never know who reads you. The thing is, her mother's a poet in her own right, and has been sharing poetry with her and her siblings for years. So she was familiar with my poetry, and I was like, wow, that is pretty amazing. After that, I was like, okay,
Yeah.
And with Bruce, we started talking about how he knows his poetry as well, especially, of course, the beat poets and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And he says he likes to write a poem first and then turn them into lyrics, which working on a musical now, I can see how that works, because my composer would rather me sort of just write a poem and then he'll like turn that core into like into lyrics and rhyming lyrics, right? Sure. But you could certainly see that in his work, right? There's a certain evocativeness and a sensuality that comes from, and a simplicity that comes from poetry as well.
Yeah, that is so cool.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been a fun.
What a ride. Okay. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on our little show.
Sure.
Anything else that you want to highlight before we get into the realm of bad poetry?
No, I mean, not in terms of career stuff or you know, celebrity gossip, but
sure.
But I did make Beyonce too.
name drop there them all. Go. It's good. You know,
she sang, if you'll remember, she sang the national anthem at the 2013. Right. But I will say that, and I haven't done this in a while, but I used to begin my undergraduate poetry courses, like the 3000, you know, the first one. Mm-hmm. I would bring in Hallmark cards and I would bring in like, and their first assignment was write the worst poem you can. Like, and yes. There is an anthology, which I've lost, but it's called like 101 really bad poems.
Oh, we need to get our hands on that. Yeah.
And I think there's something interesting, because we look at like the bad poems and then they can recognize a bad poem, right? Like, mm-hmm. And when they can write a really bad poem, but then it's funny when it's this is not just the students, it's all of us, right? Like when it comes down to writing a real poem of your own, you lose that critical faculty of like. So I was like, but wait, you just wrote a really bad poem and it's not that much better. Like, you know, it's funny how those faculties just leave us, right? Because of course we're so much more invested and so much complex emotions are going that cloud our memory, and the process of getting to a good poem is the clarity of thought, of emotion, of a certain, you know, lucidity that happens by the act of failing, right?
Yeah. Wow. Well, Dave, let's see how lucid you were when you wrote this week's poem.
Okay. This is my poem called Rye, Blue, and Yellow. Blooming bursts of yellow, growing from a sea of green. My soul feels the mellow through neighbors' comments mean. They cultivate a meaningless crop, made for society's mundane call. Myself, I like to pick the top and make dandelion alcohol.
Those are pretty good rhymes, though. Slap rhymes,
why not? Right? I felt it was very cute.
Yeah. It's also justification for an unkept
lawn. Is that a thing, though? Can you actually make alcohol of dandelion?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know what happens. Well, if there's ever a vodka shortage, I know what to do.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. My sister makes dandelion wine. Do you do that, Dave?
I've been making mead for about 2 years now, and this year is going to be my first time trying to make dandelion wine, and I've been told it's either delicious and refreshing and great, or it tastes like rancid butter and just the worst thing you've ever put in your mouth, so we'll see how it goes.
Kind of like a poem.
There you go. That should be our new standard. What kind of dandelion wine is this? Wow. Well, Richard, you gave Dave like a compliment for that. A nice slant rhymes and everything. Yeah. I think
it's not my fault I'm a genius. These things just happen sometimes.
We could retire into the sunset now. This is But let's get into the poems that you have brought for us today. You've given us a couple that went nowhere, and then some that have been reworked and have finally found kind of the light of day. So let's start with one that went nowhere, and we'll maybe discuss where sure. you think it failed.
So I think, and so give you a little history about this first one. So I think sometimes poems fail, and I profess this to my students and myself all the time, is I have to remind myself all the time to never put the idea before the poem, right? Like, because then we're just expounding and we're not really discovering anything new. We've already made up what the poem is going to be about and whatnot. And frankly, they're just not that much fun to write as that poem that sort of you're just kind of, you know, going with the flow, and then something miraculously, there's some kind of moment, you know, where you like discover something that you didn't come to the page with. And so this first poem, which is Emily Dickinson's recurring dream of a failed bridge, was actually my second book. I was going to write, you know, the best poetry book ever written in the world, you know, like, and it's, as you mentioned, I'm an engineer, and I thought my first book had to do a lot with cultural identity, place, belonging, sure. the themes that are still with me, but I ran away from that. Okay. And I thought I was going to do this book about bridges and bridging, crossing the bridge from the sciences into the arts. And at one point the manuscript is called Bridge of Tongues. It was a complete, I wrote like a 15 page long poem about the Golden Gate Bridge. When I found out that, actually, the chief structural engineer wrote poetry, and there's a poem on the Sausalito side that he wrote when the bridge was completed. Oh. Anyway, it was all idea driven. The manuscript completely sucked. Meanwhile, I was writing all these other poems that didn't belong in the book because they weren't genius enough, which yes. had to do with all these same themes. I had been traveling a lot, home, place, those same questions, but in the context of traveling and living in different countries like Brazil and whatnot, but that wasn't genius. No, that was not the book I was going to write. So I wrote this poem to fit the book, basically. And while it's clever, you know, as we say also in poetry, you know, we just abandon poems, like we don't finish. This is an abandoned poem just because the idea of the book went away. But I was just, yeah, it was all idea driven. And if you want to know two poets that are completely opposite in the, like, polar opposites in the world, it's Emily Dickinson and Richard Blanco. Like, you know, like, I can't. I'm Cuban. Like, I mean, for me, like, a 20-line poem is like a short poem, you know? Like, so,
sure.
And I try to imitate horribly, like, Emily Dickinson's voice here. So here it is. Emily Dickinson's recurring dream of a failed bridge. Dreams. A steep bridge I am eagerly climbing up. Its apex in sight, the high goal I set to reach, ready. But it ends so, like so. Many things do. A flame, our daily endeavors, like this dreamed bridge, severed. Two ends, on one side this, I stand, no means to cross. Below, the greedy river bends, a crooked happy smile. Two ends, on that side there, spring, a lover, oh boy. And where, and where it was I never did go, where, death be not this bridge. Like, there's so many dashes in that. It's insane. Like,
yeah. For our dear listeners, I think there are at least four M dashes. There are four M dashes in every stanza.
Yeah.
So in yep. case you didn't 16. Know. Yeah.
when in Emily Dickinson, do as Emily Dickinson, right?
When in doubt, M dash.
I just realized. Spring, a lover. Well, that's clever.
Oh yeah.
But then again, I do like something like the river has a crooked smile. Like, but the poem yeah. we can sell says nothing, right? Like, because it's not my voice. Like, and it's not even like sort of to Emily Dickinson. But what does Emily Dickinson have to do with bridges? She never crossed anything. She stayed in the
side. She stayed in the side. Yeah.
Right. She never saw a bridge. And maybe that would have been a more interesting poem, right? A more personal contemplation of that irony. But frankly, mm-hmm. Richard Blanco, Emily Dickinson, just not a good pair.
I love the death be not this bridge.
Right. But that's right. And that's stolen right from another poem of hers, I think, Death Be Not, or something like that.
Death Be Not Proud? Is that
something like that, right?
Yeah. Oh man. Wow.
Like when you're Cuban, you're really melodramatic, so like to try to be extra melodramatic. I have to actually always cut that back, you know. I have to, like, because I can be wrought, but then I can be overwrought, and so it's like this fine balance between, you know, between those that fine line between those two things.
I will say I do hear Emily Dickinson in this, and it feels, when in a musical, when you have a dancer who's supposed to be pretending to be bad at dancing, like you can right. tell if that person actually knows what they're doing. Like, right, if I'm right. pretending to be a bad dancer, I'm terrible because I'm not good enough at dancing to know what's bad in dancing.
Yeah, you're right. That's a great analogy. Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of, I'm a good dancer, obviously, being Cuban, but if I do say so myself, but I do that sometimes. Like, so we live in a part of the year, I live in my home in Maine. And this is the thing we go see really bad white people dancing. And then I start dancing like them, and my husband cracks up and is like, he can't dance. But it is funny, like, because, you know, I'm having a blast, but it's like I can't even dance as bad as them because I know how to dance. Well, speaking of Julie Louis-Dreyfus, remember that episode
where the she kicks dance? And whatnot?
Yeah, that's kind of like what I do. Nice.
Oh, wow. So this was an abandoned poem because you, knowing what good poetry was, you trying to imitate Emily Dickinson, you just knew it didn't click, right?
Yeah, and like that, there were, I think, a bunch in the manuscript. But also, there's nothing of me in there. You know, like, at the end of the day, it's again, it's the idea versus the, as I say in my classes, you know, that in the contemporary context, the discovery is the poem, right? It's the thing that you discover is what makes that poem and the reader go like, oh, shit. Like, wow. And you can see the process of getting there, right? Of course, the poem gets revised, but most of the drafting is get to that point where there's not where the essence of the poem emerges from the practice of actually just writing the poem or attempting the poem. So this poem knew what it wanted to be right from the beginning. It was never going to go anyplace else. And in that way, it's like, you know, I abandoned it.
Sure. So on the engineering side of things, did you ever design a bridge?
Yeah, I used to. So that was part of like what I wanted to sort of include in the book. So for a while, I specialized in what's called bridge hydrology, which a lot of people think is the guy that's, you know, sitting in the booth raising the drawbridge.
Right.
Yeah. So it's not. So bridge hydrology, when you first start to design a bridge, you actually have to study the flood basin, study the river or the estuary, and model all kinds of things, and then you create this like 200-page report that then goes to the structural engineer that tells the structural engineer how to build the bridge in terms of its foundation, because that's usually why bridges get washed out. It's not if the bridge hydrologist doesn't do the correct math, then the bridge stands no chance. So, but it was really also a very contemplative thing, because you actually go out and like to the river and like wade in the river, and it's almost like you commune with the river, and like, and it's funny, like a little creek will, you know, when you look at the flood maps, will widen to like, you know, a floodplain of hundreds and hundreds of feet. So you have to build a bridge that long because it looks like it's just a little creek, but it's not, you know, like, so all sorts of interesting parts to that. And yeah, there's a great metaphor in that, but I write some engineering poems that are successful, but they're more like hermit crab poems where I borrow some of the language or some of the concepts, like you'll see, in one of the poems I have for us today, and that's different because that I'm close to, right? Like that, sure. I can own that in a different way. But yeah.
just going to say, you don't usually think of engineering poetry. Like, when I think of poetry, because I am a cultureless swine, I usually think of, like, oh, isn't the sun pretty and stuff. So it's very fun to have, like, you know, some engineering background bridging that gap. I just wish someone would write a book of, like, beautiful engineering poetry, like the best engineering poetry.
No, I don't know that that's going to happen. But like, there is a book that changed my life that's called The Existential Pleasures of Engineering, which sounds like a really bad porn movie. But or something by Kafka. Yeah, I don't know. Like, but and it's what gave me permission to sort of. I had been working in my engineering office for several years before I started writing in my engineering office because half my job was writing reports, studies, letters, and proposals, which were like the lifeblood of, you know, getting a $40 million job awarded. So I really started keying into language in a way that I had never before, but in a way that was also like hands-on, like my job, that was my job. And so that's actually what, so I didn't start writing until I was 27. It was partly understanding how important language is in anything that sort of keyed me into that. I always wanted to do something creative in addition to my engineering. But what I've learned along the way too is that, at least for me, and I always tell my students this as well, you know, like every endeavor in life, it takes both left and right faculties of the brain, right? Mm-hmm. And the best things happen when those things synthesize. When you begin a poem, for me, it's like there's no left brain. It's like, you know, the only left brain activity at the beginning of the poem is making a martini. And then and then it's just pure explosion of creativity, just throwing Jell-O on the page and seeing what sticks. But slowly, what you're looking for, right, is patterns, right? You're looking for logical connections. You have to build an internal logic to the poem and then break that logic, right? And so it's a lot of like, besides the music of a poem too, which is mathematical, like in the way that music is. So I wouldn't say engineering itself, but all the math that I've taken, it also, it's a problem solving skill. And sometimes I think of a poem as an emotional proof. It's like an emotional geometric proof. And I'm trying to find, you have the givens and you're having to piece by piece, line by line, see how those things are connecting to like draw, you know, the conclusion, right? Like, or the discovery. So I've learned that, you know, you need both. And I think it comes back. Like, I think how we talk about revision is really weird because I think we tend to inadvertently profess as writers that, oh, you draft a poem and then you revise it. It doesn't work that way. You're in constant revision, even when you're drafting the first poem. And, you know, it's a loop. It's not this linear process. Oh, now I'm going to, you know, revise the poem. No, like, and then there's moments in revision that are other complete, bring on complete spurts of new creativity that go back to sort of the initial poetry building world, which is just again, throwing Jell-O on the page. Even though you've drafted a good part of the poem, there's still moments where you have to, where you enter into that deep creative space. And then, you know, so it's like an iterative process, like an iterative equation where you don't know the answer. You just keep on substituting values till the one side equals the other.
This is the perfect, this is the perfect segue into one calculus, I think. So right. I think we should dive into that because I think is uncertain C principle. I feel like I just read that last night. Is that in your newest collection?
Yeah, that's in the new collection.
Perfect. So we get to see the beginnings of that.
Right. So this poem comes from, again, more of an idea poem, but I became, so this is a villanelle. And so for those listeners that might not know, a villanelle repeats entire lines in a pattern throughout the poem. And so I thought about that and thinking about X and Y, my math background, and sort of trying to create a trope around it, but it kind of, I don't know, well, you'll be the judge, it kind of never got someplace And okay. I have pages and pages and pages and pages and pages of drafts of this poem. But again, it was like, this is a really good idea. You know? And I'm going to use a villanelle because it repeats two lines, right? So
and X's and poem. Y's. So, yeah, okay.
Right. So one calculus. I've calculated the world with X's and Y's, done the integration, the differentiation of numbers and letters without rhyme, the bend of a branch or the arc of wings. Simple, Y equals X squared, a second order equation ordered out of a world of X's and Y's. An I for a sun or the sun for a dime, circles all the same, easy configurations of a pencil over a page without rhyme. I'll tell you, with the simplest curves and lines, I've built bridges, changed rivers, destinations, and designed the world out of X's and Y's. I can even break a wave into cosines, slice the moon, translate every fascination into numbers and letters, but no rhyme. Watch me take the square root of my imagination, divide by zero, scramble the constellations, continue to X the world and find all its Y's till a rose's spiral, calculate it, unrhymes. So I will say, like, so I'm also like really anal retentive as an engineer. And I'm tempted to say I have no bad poems. only because if I don't get them to some place where I feel at least they are decent, I'll just abandon the notes. Like, sure. And I insist on, like, and it's hard for me to move on to the next poem, you know, and of course to varying degrees of success or not success, but like I don't consider them bad poems, I just consider them poems that just don't do anything. Yeah. But I don't know if I'm explaining myself. Like, yeah. I need to get to like a decent draft, or else I can't move on to the next poem.
And then
I may never publish the poem. But at least I feel like, okay, I was able to pull something off. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. You can tell this wasn't just thrown to the page and left. You polished this a bit.
Oh, and like I said, I got pages and pages.
Yeah.
I was driving my husband crazy. Like, and this poem it was. God, I remember we were living in Guatemala at the time, so that's at least 15, 20 years ago. And he's a scientist, so he loved the idea of the poem. And I was like, no, I don't want to see another draft. Like, I'm done with this poem. It was obsessive. And I think that's also bad, right? Like when we get obsessed about a poem or an idea. So usually I can get to a draft enough where I can put the poem away. Or I give myself that week and a half. And if it's not going anywhere, I have a folder that's called startups. And I believe me, I went through, oh my God, what I discovered trying to find poems for you guys. Oh my God. They're like, what? I forgot I totally even wrote this. Like,
we might have to have you back on if this.
Because I'm really a good record keeper. I have poems from graduate school.
Wow.
Like,
nice.
And that was 1997.
So, if are you telling me that one calculus eventually turned into uncertain C principle?
Yes. And so,
wow.
This is the weird thing about. This is the weird thing that happens also with poetry. For this last book, which is a new and selected, for reasons I'm not going to get into, but I had to add like 10 poems extra for publishing rights, complicated poetry and publishing business crapola. And so I'm a bone dry writer because my thesis was published. So every time I finish a book, I'm kind of like, I don't have anything new. Like,
sure.
So I dug back in stuff from graduate school or some of those drafts that I never went back to. And I realized in getting these poems for y'all that villanelle turned into this poem years and years ago. And then I was asked by American Scientific to contribute a poem to a column they have about poetry. And I was like, I'm not going to write a new poem. Like, I know. And I was like, oh my God. So sometimes things that you think are failures, you're just not ready for them in your life, or the world isn't ready for them. So this got published as a new poem. And it got published, Scientific American. They did a beautiful spread with the ocean in it. So I realized it was eventually, not even knowing, that this poem was inspired or was an outgrowth of that other poem. But as you'll see here, the themes of home, belonging, identity really showed through, right? Like, it wasn't just the idea of quantum physics or like creating the world and like whatever. Interesting, this poem became part of the finale of the play that I wrote with Vanessa Garcia, which we incorporated into the script, because at the insistence of the artistic director, she's like, this is like the ending we've been looking for in this play. Mm. Like, and I'm like, are you sure? It's about Heisenberg. So and then since listeners can't see, but it's a poem that's written, it's what's called a stereoscope. So it's written in two columns, centered, justified. So you can read it as one column down, and like a newspaper, or you can read it left to right, like you would a poem. So it works in more than one way. So Heisenberg, for those of you who don't know, the uncertainty principle basically says that, you know, the more you know one thing, the less you can know about another factor, right? Because us looking at something already affects what we're not seeing, right? So I took that as a metaphor here for my own quest for finding the self. And it's full of sea imagery, which is my go-to all the time. So here we go. Uncertain sea principle, S-E-A principle, after Werner Heisenberg. The more I measure X, the less I can measure Y. The more I know where I am, the less I know where I'm going. I scribble my name across the sand. The burnt orange moon rises, cools, disappears. The more I know where I'm going, the less I know how to get there. The ebb of each wave seduces me. Silhouettes of sailboats sleep till morning. The more I know how to get there, the less I know when I'll arrive. Freighter lights burn on the horizon. Sea oats sway to the wind's pitch, like candelabras floating toward port, like inverted pendulums of timelessness. The more I know when I'll arrive, the less I know where I am. The tide rises on cue to kiss the shore hello. Seagulls obey every night. The less I try to solve for Y, the more I can solve for X. The less I know where I am, the more I know where I've been. Rustling palms protest, losing their green to the darkness. The sea gives and gives itself to the shore. It returns again and again to itself. The less I know where I've been, the more I know who I can be. The ocean vanishes into the midnight sky. The midnight sky vanishes into the ocean. The less I know who I can be, the more I know who I am. There's no horizon in the stark night. Even in the dark, my eyes shape clouds. The less I know who I am, the more I know that I am here. I erase my name with a wave of my palm. I clutch a fistful of sand, breathe, listen. The more I try to determine my I, the less I can determine my self. So, you see, there's a lot more of me in there, right? Like,
it's so different.
Yeah. And the imagery, and like that other, the other one had no imagery, which is, you know, foundation of poetry, sensory details, and yeah. So there's this poem. So in a way, I had put this poem away and thought, it's an outlier, at least, if not a failure, at least an outlier. I'm like, I'm not writing about math anymore.
Well, I feel terrible because now that we've observed it, we've changed the outcome of how it functions.
Right. Right.
Woo, Heisenberg jokes.
I did want to ask, because I've encountered, what do you call these, stereographs? Is that what they're called?
Stereoscopes.
Stereoscopes. Okay. Stereoscopes.
Yeah.
I've encountered these before, and I've always wondered, and again, this is a debate that we've had in the past about like author's intent versus like the reader's understanding. You did something here, and I don't know if you even caught it, but in the roughly the middle stanza where it's the less I know where I am, the more I know where I've been, after the single line break. When it gets to the rustling palms protest losing, you then jumped down a line and read "they're green to the darkness" and then went back up to read "the sea gives."
Right.
That's the only time in the poem that you chose to read down before going over.
Right.
And so like, I've always wondered, like, are there days where you're like, oh, I just prefer to read the left side first and then the right? Or when you encounter these poems, or when you have to read these poems that you've written aloud, how do you make that choice?
Yeah. I think sometimes I'll read it a couple of ways just to, if you know, this it, and it's more of a poem that you have to see on the page too. So I discover little things. I mean, some of them are tighter or connect more interestingly, but you can also read it down the left side. Like, the less I try to solve for why, the less I know where I am. Rustling palms protest losing their green darkness. You know, like, they can just read it like a column, like a newspaper article too. Yeah.
It's so fun. Now, do you think that the X and Y is what ultimately led you to writing in two columns? Like, was that?
Yeah. And the idea of the duality, right? So and the stereoscope, right? You can see it one way, then you can't see it the other way. You know, you can't see it both ways at the same time, right?
Yeah.
So that made sense. Stereoscope, so it comes from it goes back to the Victorian era, but you know, remember our viewfinders, those it's the idea that there's two separate images and then blending makes the picture. Right. Like, and it looks like three dimensions. So there's another word for it that's more popular, but I forget what it is, another term for it. But you want to sort of introduce the next poem kind of thing, conversation?
Well, I want to respect your time. So do we want to do a short one? We could do the paper shredded haiku and then call it a day.
No. We can do the
The Only
Golf
Island?
Motel. I think that's much more worth it. Yeah. No, okay, yeah, The Only Island and then Golf Motel. I'm not going to read any of those comments. I just thought it was interesting for you to see feedback comments. So
yeah. Okay, cool. Let's do it.
All right. So this poem, and I was thinking earlier that sometimes those poems that we think are failures and we put them away and then somehow we end up sharing them and then like, oh my God, you know, you realize it's an incredible because of the feedback from the audience or readers. And this poem had a similar trauma. So when I moved to Miami the first time, moved out and moved back the first time, moved out again, and now moved back part-time, I was very much in love with my old Miami, my memories of my old Miami and South Florida in general. And so like anybody taking trips down memory lane and trying to see these old places that, you know, from my childhood and even my teenage years. And one of those places was the Gulf Motel, which was a poor man's vacation, like in the middle of July, like, you know, somewhere in Marco Island on the West Coast. And so I went there and of course thinking nothing had changed because our memories don't change. In fact, they get even more colored, right? And so I wrote, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you'll see the gist of where that poem ended up becoming. And I was just like really pissed off, you know, like I was like, swearing, you know, cussing like a sailor and like, how dare they, you know, blah, 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 during my childhood. Like, and what I was talking about, the moment of discovery, that discovery wasn't here yet. I was just, you know, like just venting. And so I'll just read you a little piece of the first draft. It's called The Only Island. There should be nothing here I don't remember. No curtain of luxury condos eclipsing the beach with their colossal shadows and imperial names towering above rows of perfectly spaced palms along wide, widened avenues. There should be no island disfigured by fishing canals and golf courses, nor made to order mansions. No, just one just like the other, sitting like a cake decoration on flawless lawns. There should only be what I remember, only the second floor efficiency of the Gulf Motel with linoleum tiles, a kitchenette, and the sea in the window, blah, blah, blah. So it goes on, like, you'd see, like, there's a slightly pissed off there.
Like, yeah, just a little.
And then my partner, Mark, said, that's the worst poem you've ever written. And I said, no, it's not. Like, it says exactly what I want it to say. And he was there with me, like when we were looking for this place or, touring, not touring, but going down memory lane.
Yeah.
And I wanted to show, oh, this is where I used to play. And this is all of these great memories. I realized, as I said, it says exactly what I want to say, right? The golden rule of writing, show, don't tell. And I realized that, where was the showing? And so I basically abandoned the entire poem and kept the only one line that I found was interesting. And that was a mystery to me, right? There was somehow a psychologically mysterious and also linguistically mysterious. And it's the line, there should be nothing here I don't remember. And as you can tell from the snippet of the first one, there's a big narrative distance. I'm not in the poem. I'm just bitching about stuff, but I'm not diving into the core emotion or the deeper emotion that I discover in this poem. Still, when I finished the poem, I still thought, maybe because it's vestiges of like that horrible poem before. And I remember the day I first read it, everybody's like, that poem is just, people are crying in the audience. I'm like, that piece of shit? I'm like, really? And then it ended up becoming the first poem in my third book and the title of the book itself, Looking for the Gulf Motel. So here's the somewhat finished and not finished. Well, it's finished for now. I'm not going to change it. But
sure.
The deeper, the poem within the poem that, you know, that comes out of a failure. Looking for the Gulf Motel, Marco Island, Florida. There should be nothing here. I don't remember. The Gulf Motel with mermaid lampposts and ship's wheel in the lobby should still be rising out of the sand like a cake decoration. My brother and I should still be pretending we don't know our parents, embarrassing us as they roll the luggage cart past the front desk, loaded with our scruffy suitcases, 2 dozen loaves of Cuban bread, brown bags bulging with enough mangoes to last the entire week, our pressure cooker, the espresso pot, and a pork roast reeking garlic through the lobby. All because we can't afford to eat out. Not even on vacation. Only 2 hours from our home in Miami, but far enough away to be thrilled by the whiter sands on the west coast of Florida, where I should still be, for the first time, watching the sun set instead of rise over the ocean. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My mother should still be in the kitchenette of the Gulf Motel, her daisy sandals from Kmart still squeaking across the linoleum, still gorgeous in her teal swimsuit and amber earrings, stirring a pot of arroz con pollo, adding sprinkles of onion powder and dollops of tomato sauce. My father should still be in a terry cloth jacket, smoking, clinking a glass of amber whiskey in the sunset at the Gulf Motel, watching us dive into the pool, 2 boys. He'll never see grow into men who will be proud of him. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My brother and I should still be playing Parcheesi. My father should still be alive, slow dancing with my mother on the sliding glass balcony of the Gulf Motel. No music, only the waves keeping time. a song only their minds hear, 10,000 nights back to their life in Cuba. My mother's face should still be resting against his bare chest, like the moon resting on the sea. And the stars should still be turning around them. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My brother should still be 13, sneaking rum in the bathroom and sculpting naked women from sand. And I should still be 8 years old, dazzled by seashells and how many seconds I can hold my breath underwater. But I'm not. I'm 38, driving up Collier Boulevard, looking for the Gulf Motel, for everything that should still be, but isn't. I want to blame the condos, their shadows for ruining the beach and my past. I want to chase the snowbirds away with their tacky McMansions and yachts. I want to turn the golf courses back into mangroves. I want to find the Gulf Motel exactly as it was and pretend for a moment nothing lost is lost. So, a lot more showing, right?
Yes. Like,
but what the real sort of, when we're talking about discovery, right? What's the deeper emotion, right? What's the more complex emotion? And it wasn't, you know, anger is a symptom emotion, right? And and that anger, this poem made me dig into what that anger was about, and it was at many layers. It's not just about nostalgia. It was also about, basically, in some sense, of the first brushes with real mortality, that the world moves and doesn't give a shit about you, you know, like the lack of human agency. But then there's also, I think in this poem, and also there's the contradiction that even though this place is lost, I found it, right? Because
it's right there.
Yeah. And you think I liked watching my parents dance and smooch on the balcony when I was 12 years old? Like, no. I mean, I used to kick and scream, oh God, not we're going to Marco Island again and embarrassing us with the food. Like, you know, I want to listen to AC/DC and, like, you know, whatever. Like, and then it speaks to the old cliche of you don't know what you got till you lost it. So if the Gulf Motel would have been there, I would have probably dismissed it in the same way that I had before.
Right.
But the fact that it wasn't there made it all the more special. And then also, you know, saving that kind of disappointment, or I guess a little bit more of the anger towards the end of the stanza, where, like, okay, now you're going to feel that loss with me because I just took you through it, right? I just took you through everything that was my memory. And I just kept that first line, and I said, okay, Richard, go, like, start writing. Just start writing. Like, and every time I would come to a stopping point, I just repeat the line and go. So the whole poem, in a way, is an unpacking of what that abstract thematic line means. And I had to discover that for myself. This is such a personal memory, but so many people connect with this poem because, you know, beyond my own power or willfulness of being a poet, but there's a nerve that everybody has a place like this in their life, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the stories that I hear from people of, like, I mean, it's not always a motel. Sometimes it's an old aunt's house that they used to visit, or, you know, a vacation spot somewhere else. There's always this little North Star somewhere in our hearts from our childhood that, you know, that stays with us. And we kind of, it's there, and we never really touch upon it. And then when we do, we realize, oh my God, like, so anyway, all that, I realize how special and how, you know, despite being working class and lower working class, how my parents managed to create these beautiful memories for us that I couldn't appreciate at the time and can only do so as an adult. And when they're gone, and they're not gone, right?
Well, and that is just fascinating, because, like, when you read the first one, I connected to it because you are an extremely talented writer who can get us emotionally invested. But thinking it through in the first one, it was just, yeah, I'm angry that my childhood is gone, and that's all I got from it. Like, I fell into it, but it didn't take me anywhere. But this one, there were so many lines where you could have stopped, and I could have just sat in silence for like a minute, just living my childhood and also living part of yours. Just incredible.
Yeah, that's what happens in the best of circumstances with art, where it no longer, as we say in poetry, it's no longer my poem, right? Like,
right.
But I realized again, the critical mistakers was telling and not showing. So,
right,
you know, to make you miss your own place, I have to show you mine, right?
Yeah,
and all its details, and then I take it away from you at the end, right? Like,
right.
So even the structure of the poem changed. It wasn't like, you know, you don't realize the narrator is actually literally physically looking for this place, driving around, and you're like, shit, like it even surprised me. I'm like, so I had the poem backwards. See, that happens too when poems fail, and we look for that too. Like sometimes the beginning of a poem is really the end, and it's like you have to get there, and you have to earn it, right? You have to, yeah. Right.
Yeah, I don't know if we've earned our end or not, but we do need to wrap it up. Richard, this has been such a blast. But you have given us two beautiful poems already. So typically, at the end of My Bad Poetry, we end each week with the words of a true poet. You've already ended our time with the words of one of your published works. If you're willing, by all means, you could share another one at this point. Otherwise, we'll just we'll call it a day and hope it's a good one.
No, I think we're good with Ghost Motel.
Yeah, I agree.
The poem I have to live up to the rest of my life.
This has been My Bad Poetry.
Now go on and write some really bad poetry to get to the good ones.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Richard. This is an honor. It was great to meet you.
Same here.
Yeah.
Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too.
You too. Thank you.
Bye.
He's so talented.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Rhyme free does matter. It's my